Lecture 8. Heroes at the Pass.
Welcome back. We have reached a point of crisis, not only in the history of Greece, but in the history of the world, and of the Persian Empire as well. It is late summer of the year 480, our month of August. Xerxes is making his way south with his immense army, his engineers in front as they pass through the range that includes Mount Olympus there in northern Greece, his engineers straightening and smoothing the roads so that the horses and the men can get through this mountainous region on their way to the pass at Thermopylae. His fleet, meanwhile, is giving him a few days' lead. They are waiting up there in the port of what is today modern Thessaloniki, and they are going to follow Xerxes then southward, they going down the coast of Magnesia, passing through the Artemisian Channel, as they hope, and having a rendezvous with their lord and master, the great King Xerxes, after he has gone through the pass at Thermopylae. The Greeks, meanwhile, have gone northward from the isthmus at Corinth, where the Spartans have convened and are heading a Hellenic League, a league of freedom-fighting Greeks who, a couple of dozen strong, have decided that against all odds, they will face this immense invasion and try to save their homelands and their freedom. They have now divided themselves in two under Athenian inspiration. There's now a naval arm rowing northward, headed for the Artemisian Channel to try to block the advance of Xerxes' armada at sea. And although that is led by a Spartan, Eurybiades, the mastermind of that policy and the man who is really directing the strategy of that fleet is the Athenian Themistocles. And almost two-thirds of the fleet are the 200 Athenian triremes that the Athenians have recently built to transform themselves, sort of pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps into this great naval power. But our focus at first will be on the land enterprise, which is under the leadership of a Spartan king, a very famous man today, a very famous man ever since the events that happened in that narrow pass at Thermopylae, a man named Leonidas. He has attached to his army of 7,000 as they go north one little scout ship, a 30-oared vessel, an Athenian vessel, with a commander named Habronikos. And that scout ship will watch the events at Thermopylae in the pass from the sea and then carry word eastward to the navy to let the men in the fleet, to let Eurybiades, the Spartan commander or admiral, and Themistocles, the Athenian commander, to let them know how Leonidas and the men are faring in the pass at Thermopylae. So whatever goes on at Thermopylae will be reported by this little scout ship to the Greeks off to the east, holding the pass at sea. It's time to talk a little bit about the Spartans and about the kind of man that Leonidas was. Let's start with Leonidas himself. The Spartans are an anomaly among Greek peoples. They have gone a different path, certainly very different from that of the Athenians and the Ionians, who are expansive, adventuresome, experimental, talkative, love to thrash things out, love to explore all possibilities, like to cross new horizons. Believers in entrepreneurship, free enterprise, privatization of all kinds of things, building up of great fortunes. That's the world of the Ionian Greeks and the Athenians, the Corinthians, and many other Greeks. It was that world that created the explosive diaspora of the Greeks that carried Greek colonists to the Black Sea, to the coasts of Asia, to Sicily, Italy, France, and even Spain and North Africa. The Spartans had a grand total of one colony. That was Tarentum in Italy. They didn't take part in all of this adventuresomeness. The Spartans had gone a different path. They were the Dorian tribe of Greeks, the Dorian nation of Greeks, who'd settled down in the southern and eastern quadrant of that landmass, the Peloponnese. They had dug in there after the so-called return of the sons of Heracles, the Dorian invasion of around 1200 BC, and for generations, they had been living there, working their farms, being sort of ordinary Greeks. But then, a few hundred years before the Persian Wars and the invasion of King Xerxes, the Spartans conquered their neighbors to the west, their close cousins, the Messenians, and took over their territory. Suddenly, they had a little empire. Their two Spartan kings, who, as I said before, are really just generals for life. They're military leaders, ceremonial leaders. They're not monarchs in the autocratic sense of running the country. Their two kings, their little group of five ephors or elder counselors, and their assembly of warriors are now governing both Sparta and this conquered realm of Messenia, which included the kingdom of old King Nestor, whom I quoted last time from Homer's Iliad, that Homeric king who ruled at Pylos in the southwest corner of the Peloponnese. So they are masters of the southern half, or almost the southern two-thirds, of the Peloponnese. There's still people that hold out against their power in the Peloponnese. The people of Argos, to the north and east of them, are fiercely independent of the Spartans. But the Spartans themselves now have a country that they must police and watch and keep under their authority. They've already militarized themselves for the running war between the Messenians and themselves, which took so many years to win, and now they remain in active service permanently. For other Greeks, being a soldier was something to be taken up temporarily. You're a young man, you become a soldier of fortune, you go off to the ends of the Mediterranean, you fight for a foreign power and bring the wealth home. Or your city-state is suddenly threatened by an invasion from your neighbor, and you go out and fight a battle on a summer day and then go home and put the shield in the corner of the room and lay down your helmet, and maybe spiders come and weave their webs over your shield, and a beehive gets made in your helmet, and everything is peaceful. It's not like that in Sparta. From the time they conquered Messenia, the Spartans become, in a sense, imperialists. They've got a little empire. It's there in the Peloponnese. And their great goal in life is to hold on to it, to keep things stable. They are, in fact, a tiny minority in their own country because they have the Messenians to their west, whom they rule. And within Lacedaemon, the Spartan home territory, Sparta itself is technically just the capital city, within Lacedaemon or Laconia, their home territory, the main bulk of the population are people called Helots, H-E-L-O-T-S. These are the workers, the serfs, almost with the status of slaves, people bound to the land, people who do not have wealth of their own, not that any Spartan is after wealth in this life. And this resentful population of people who are doing all the work, this isn't like a typical Greek city-state where the hoplite warrior puts away his armor and goes out and helps with the olive harvest or supervises the getting in of the grain. No, the Spartans are full-time warriors. It's the Helots who do the work, and the Helots are always, or almost always, looking for opportunities to regain their freedom and get rid of these pesky Spartans. One can understand some of the resentment that the Helots and the Messenians feel when you consider how the Spartans are brought up. It's a method of upbringing that the aristocrats of other Greek cities really admired. If they could, they got young Spartan girls to Sicily or to Athens to be nursemaids for aristocratic babies because they wanted that toughness bred into their children. Spartans had their children brought up by the women for a while, but then taken away. And boys and girls alike trained in athletics, in the arts of warfare, in toughness. Girls were not expected to fight, but girls were expected to grow up and bear strong Spartan boys who would be the next generation of warriors. And so they too had to be fit and strong and competitive. The boys are sent off to school. They are not learning philosophy. They are not learning mathematics. They're certainly not learning anything about trade. No Spartan sullied his hands with anything mercantile. The gold that various people brought to Sparta to try to bribe the Spartans into helping out with various wars was often sent away and discussed. The Spartans were interested in honor. The Spartans were interested in a pure military society. And so the boys graduated from these sort of boot camps for children, where they learned to be tough, to fight, to endure, to hide their hunger, to hide their ordinary human feelings. They graduated into manhood through a frightening sort of act of initiation called the krypteia, the hidden thing, where they would go out and live off the land for a while, stealing, killing to survive. And the test was, can you do it without being caught? One of the elements of the krypteia was to hunt down and kill a Helot without being caught. So it was a brutal life, and it was turning men into fighting machines. but fighting machines that still had a thought in their head, and that thought was honor. I must never dishonor myself. And it wasn't so much for foreign wars. Sparta was not trying to expand. Sparta was simply trying to maintain mastery of its homelands and of this conquered realm of Messenia on the other side of Mount Taygetos. And to do that, they became militarized as no other Greek people had ever been militarized. They looked to their two kings, who were each descended from Heracles by different genealogies, and maintained two separate royal houses and royal lines. They looked to their two kings typically for leadership in the field. And when they went away to war, they were a little like the Persians. They carried their altars with them, and they prayed to the gods. They sacrificed before battle. War was a great ceremony for them, a religious experience. All of this in the service of maintaining that permanent hold on their land. As an adult male, you did not live at home with your wife. You were in your mess tent. Even the king was in the mess tent with his fellows, sharing the black bread, the black broth, the simple water or rough wine, there with his fellows in the mess tent. Not surprisingly, Spartan population was a bit of a problem. They were always seemingly in decline, fewer and fewer Spartans. Ultimately, the state of Sparta had to offer bonuses to couples that would actually produce children. Nonetheless, it was a way of life that was intensely admired by other Greeks, as I said, especially aristocrats, especially Athenian aristocrats, who looked south and saw in Sparta some sort of ideal. Well, the Spartans certainly thought of themselves as the ideal also. They respected themselves and nobody else. And they were wonderful people in a crisis because you knew they would never back down. They would never surrender. They would always be willing to hold their post. Not typically the most imaginative of military strategists, not people who used a lot of cunning or art, as the Athenian Themistocles had done as he worked out how he thought the Persians could actually be beaten. But certainly in the right place, and the pass at Thermopylae showed every indication of being the right place, they would be the people who you wanted on the spot. They were led on this occasion, in late summer of 480 BC, by a man who grew up never expecting to be king. He was the half-brother of that King Cleomenes, who had been visited in the year 499 BC, 19 years before this invasion of Xerxes, by Aristagoras of Miletus, that Ionian who crossed the sea with his bronze map and showed the Spartans, the Persian Empire, asked them to come across the sea and liberate the Greeks of Asia and conquer the Persians. And Cleomenes had sent Aristagoras away once he found that the capital of the Persian Empire was 3 months from the sea. No Spartan would ever be that far from home. And now you understand why. They've got a threat permanently at home, these disaffected peoples that they must keep down. Cleomenes had died unexpectedly in very complicated and mysterious circumstances. He had become a man who was so convinced of his own talents, he wanted to be a real king and rule. He had many enemies within Sparta. It's not entirely clear exactly how he met his end. But suddenly his half-brother, Leonidas, which means something like son of the lion, was catapulted into the kingship. Now, the lion is a symbol of Sparta. Leonidas, Leotichides, we're going to meet a lot of Spartans with that Leo, lion, in their name. There really were lions in Greece at this time. Xerxes had discovered to his sorrow that the mountain lions of northern Greece developed a taste for camels, and they would attack his baggage train as he marched along with his great army from the Hellespont into the mountains of northern Greece. Lions symbolize for the Greeks, as you can see from Aesop's fables, strength, majesty, toughness, large-mindedness, big-heartedness, ferociousness. All of this was what it was to be a lion, and in turn, all of this is what it was to be a Spartan. And we have a few works of art from the archaic period in Sparta, where they created lions, and when they buried their dead on the battlefields, they would often erect a lion over the mass tomb of Spartan warriors to show that here lies a set of men who were lions' sons. Leonidas had not accomplished anything of note by the summer of 480. He'd been king for several years, succeeding his half-brother, but he was chosen. He didn't volunteer, and it was certainly not his policy. He was chosen by the Spartan assembly of warriors led by the five ephors, the magistrates, to be the king who would break the Olympic truce. They were holding the Olympic Games in 480, and he would lead this little contingent of 300 Spartan warriors north, while the rest of the Spartans stayed home and completed the festivals for Zeus. He would also be the leader of a larger allied contingent on land, 4,000 hoplite, heavily armed warriors from the Peloponnese, 3,000 from central Greece, but minus the Athenians, remember, who are all in their ships with the fleet, committed completely to holding Xerxes back at sea. They marched through the plains of Boeotia, past the city of Thebes, and became aware that all around them there was a sort of a rot in central Greece, as the heralds of Xerxes, who had been south, asking people to give earth and water to the king to show their submission and save themselves, had undermined the feeling of resistance. The Greeks in the center part of Greece were well aware that a wall was being built across the Isthmus of Corinth, that the Peloponnesians were only half-heartedly believing that they could save central Greece. Attica, remember, had already been evacuated by the Athenians, who took the bold step of sending their wives and children away, so that even if Xerxes broke through, he would find only an empty city. So a lot of Greeks were doing what was called in that year Medizing. Now remember the group of Asiatics whom the Greeks had encountered first of this Medes and the Persians were the Medes. They often called them the barbarian or the Mede when they were properly speaking the Persians. It was just a shift in nomenclature that they'd gotten in the habit of. And so they invented this word Medizing for any Greek who went over to the Persian side, submitted, and then fought for the great king. Well, there were Medizers all over. And a lot of the people in the great city of Thebes, Oedipus' old city, had decided to Medize. So Leonidas did not get a full levy of soldiers, as he had expected, from central Greece. And he was always thinking that the main Spartan army was just a few days behind him and was going to come up and commit to the defense of Greece at that narrow pass at Thermopylae. When he arrived at Thermopylae, he had 7,000 men. That was enough to hold the pass. In fact, deploying more would have been a problem. Remember, as I said last time, the cart road that ran through the pass at Thermopylae, the only way into central Greece for an army, certainly an army with wheeled vehicles, it was only sort of like it wasn't even as wide as a two-lane blacktop. And to have 1.5 million men trying to get through it, as Xerxes allegedly had, it didn't matter how many there were, they could still be plugged and prevented from going further by a small force in the pass. Nonetheless, Leonidas did not go north thinking he was going to a last stand or a forlorn hope. He thought he was the vanguard of a great army. As we'll see, that great army never materialized as the Spartans changed their mind, not thinking Xerxes would move so fast, and left Leonidas out there alone to figure out how to hold that pass. When he got to Thermopylae, he found a very different place from what you see today if you visit Thermopylae. Thermopylae today is the main four-lane divided highway that comes down from the north into central Greece. 18-wheelers are barreling along it. They go past a nice monument to the Spartans and to Leonidas there. But if you stand there on the hills and on the Spartan burial mound on one side of the highway and look, you can barely see the waters of the gulf of the sea. The Spercheios River has come down with all of its sediments, filled up the land, and created a vast plain. So you get no sense of the narrow pass that was there. It's not a pass between two mountains, as we often think of a pass being. Instead, the mountains, the precipitous mountains of central Greece, came down to almost to the water's edge. There was a tiny flat space, a little winding road at the foot of the mountains. The hot springs of Thermopylae, the hot gates with their sulfurous waters and their steam, bubbled up along that road, making progress even more treacherous and difficult. And then on the other side of the road, the cliffs fell down into the sea, cliffs that are no longer there. The bubbling travertine, the calcites from the bubbling springs, have flowed over the cliffs and created this smooth descent down to the plain. So we don't see Thermopylae as they did then. We don't realize that this was truly a place where a few men could hold off a gigantic army. Leonidas knew that there was a weakness at Thermopylae. There was a way around it. It wasn't a way that Xerxes could take his whole army. He couldn't take the cavalry and the wheeled carts up there. But it was a way that you could get a small contingent to circumvent the road through the pass, go up in the hills and get around. He knew it was there. He had 1,000 men with him from the territory of Phocis nearby. He posted them up on that high path, telling them to guard the trail so that the Persians wouldn't be able to get there, get behind him. He then planted himself in the pass itself, expecting to be able to hold off the Persians until the main army came, and then it would be the job of the main army to hold Xerxes there until winter came, and the whole thing had to be given up for that year, and as the Greeks all hoped then, given up for good. And there was, by the way, a precedent for this. You may remember when we talked about Miltiades of Athens and our run-up to the Battle of Marathon, Miltiades of Athens had been along as a vassal of King Darius when King Darius tried to invade the land of the Scythians. Well, he finally had to give up that attempt, King Darius, because the Scythians refused him a pitched battle. They just kept retreating. They were nomads, and when he sent them a message saying, stand still and fight, they said, well, we're just going about our normal nomadic business. We move from place to place. Catch us if you can. So he'd never gotten the decisive battle he wanted, and it was certainly the initial strategy of the Greeks not to give him a decisive battle, but to delay him so that he couldn't get down to the open waters of central Greece or to the open plains of central Greece, where his army or his navy could have been deployed in full force and beaten the tiny forces of the Greeks who were in place to resist him. Remember also that we've got our little Athenian guardship out there watching from beyond the bubbling mud flats, the whole thing, as if they were a scene at a play. Xerxes arrived, coming over the mountains of the north, around the corner of that gulf, crossing the Spercheius River, and his scouts informed him the pass was held against him. He surely expected this, that the Greeks would be there. There was, in fact, an old wall that the Spartans had repaired because this was a traditional place to keep northerners out of central Greece. He settled down. He got his whole army together. It took him a couple of days in order to marshal the troops in this new place and scout it out. And then he began to throw his forces at the pass to test the resistance. The first day, he picked the Medes, those partners of the Spartans, whose empire the Spartans had conquered, and sent them in. Now, remember, these are not heavily armored men like the Spartans in the pass and the other Greeks that the Spartans are leading. These Medes are lightly armored. Their shields may have been just made of wicker. They're very mobile. They're much faster. But if you're not on an open plain, the speed counts for nothing. And so the Medes had a lot of trouble. They were beaten, and they had to go back and Xerxes next tried some of his Persians. They met with the same fate. They couldn't break through that shield wall. The Spartans were standing in the phalanx. There's a reason our fingers are called phalanges. That comes from the word of phalanx. It's a row of things in tight array, very powerful together, but very weak if you spread them out. That's what a phalanx is. And so the phalanx was like the mailed fist of the Greek fighting machine. Warrior after warrior after warrior, shield to shield to shield, each man's shield on his left forearm, protecting not himself but the man to his left. So the phalanx depends for its survival on the cohesion of the shield line, and every man depends on his fellow. And the Spartan mentality was never let down another warrior, another Spartan. So they would stand in position. The lines of their national poet, Tyrtaeus, who was the great hoplite poet of more than a century back, as he wrote about, plant your feet, spread your legs, stand firm, hold that shield, never give in to the enemy. Their spears are then pointed forward, and they have one big advantage. Their spears are longer than those of the Persians. Remember, if you want to be mobile, you don't want to be encumbered with a 9-foot spear. But here, coming out of the wall of shields, were those 9-foot spears. The Medes first, then the Persians, they couldn't get through. The next day, Xerxes tried again, sending in these groups of men. The Spartans, according to Herodotus, behaved slightly different on this second day. The pass was actually a corridor. It would open up here and there into slightly wider places. It had very narrow places. For one thing, on the second day, the Spartans were clearly alternating who was on the front. So they not only spelled each other off, they would let the others come up, the other Peloponnesians, the people of central Greece, to take their turn at the front. So the front line was always fresh. And it's a day-long battle, And this way, everybody had time to sit down, have their meal, and then come back to the front and take their turn. A very sensible way to do it. One feels that Leonidas is learning on the job. They also worked out a stratagem, very surprising for the Spartans. They would pretend to stand firm, and then suddenly, they would retreat. Well, hallelujah. The Persians immediately would be off on the attack, running into the narrows of the pass, heedless of their own danger because they thought they now had the enemy in flight. And then at a signal, the Spartans or whoever was on the front line would wheel around, form that shield wall again, march forward, and now, having trapped some of the enemy in the narrows, would butcher them all. Xerxes saw contingent after contingent killed in this way, and he realized this could go on till I've got nobody left. The Spartans were losing very few. The Persians were losing large numbers because each Spartan was like an armored tank, sheathed in bronze, bronze greaves, which are shin guards, bronze body armor, a sort of cuirass for the chest area, or sometimes a sort of, it's almost like the bulletproof vest idea, padded linen, very densely woven over the breast, the great bronze shield, which was really a wooden shield with a bronze cover, the bronze helmet over their heads, that classical Corinthian-style helmet that we met before, that Miltiades of Athens also wore, with this great, fearsome crest, often dyed scarlet of horsehair along the top. And then the weaponry, the spear, the sword, often a dagger for close-in fighting in the final stages of the fight, all of this was the panoply of the hoplite warrior. You could pick out the Spartans because they had on their shields the Greek letter lambda, or L, which stood for Lacedaemon, or Laconia. So here they are, they fight through the day, they make it to the end of the day. And all this time, of course, the scouts and the translators of Xerxes' force, and he has many Greeks with him, remember, he's got all those Ionian Greek subjects, he has some Greeks with him, most of the Ionians are with the fleet, they are scouting for people who know the area. And they finally find a local Greek of a place called Malis, who Herodotus says in hopes for pay. He became a great traitor to Greece, so he was demonized. His name, Ephialtes, ironically means nightmare. He told them about the way around the pass. And Xerxes decided in the night, after the second day's fighting, to send his best troops. The Greeks call them the immortals. His spearmen, his own personal bodyguard, up that mountain track to get around behind Leonidas and trap him in the pass. They went up by night. As dawn was breaking, the people of Phocis, the men of Phocis, those 1,000 men up in the pass, heard down in the oak woods that led up to their protected position the rustling of leaves, as if a great wind were passing through the dry leaves on the ground, but there was no wind. And this terrifying sound of an army rustling through the leaves alerted them. They got up, they seized their spears and their shields, and out of the wood came that fearsome fighting force, Xerxes' immortals. They could recognize them by the silver pomegranates that were on the tips of their spears right under the blade. They turned and ran. They thought they were the target. For all they knew, Thermopylae had already fallen down there in the pass, and they ran for a high place that they knew they could defend themselves on and left the pass open. The immortals paid no more attention to the men of Phocis. They filed quickly as they could over the summit of the ridge and down the other side. And the little scout ship then out there at sea saw in the early morning light off on the sort of down end of the pass, the one toward central Greece, the immortals coming down now out of the heights ready to trap Leonidas and his men and Xerxes preparing to invade from the northern side. Leonidas got word of this, and he sent most of his troops away. He probably sent 6,000 men out of the 7,000 south to save themselves, to fight another day. This is where he turns from a man who was somewhat outgeneraled into a true hero. He himself stayed in the pass, and he fought it out that day with his 300 Spartans, the 700 men from Thespiae, and several hundred other men who'd come up from Sparta, possibly even Helots who had been given armor. They fought through the barrage of arrows. They did not surrender, which he could have. Xerxes would have been thrilled to have a captive Spartan king in his train. Instead, they fought until Their spears had been broken. They pulled their swords and fought on with the swords, close at hand to the crush of Persian warriors. Leonidas fell during the sword fight. His men would not surrender. They fought on without him until they were finally using their hands and their teeth. And when the last was killed, Xerxes knew he had taken the pass. Thermopylae had fallen. The way to central Greece lay open. And Xerxes had won his first great victory. The Athenian guardship out at sea saw the disaster, appalled, headed eastward to carry the news to the fleet, and we will follow them next time as the news of Thermopylae spreads through the world of the defenders, and they make one last stand at a place called Salamis against this gigantic invading force under the greatest king the world had ever seen, now ruling an empire even bigger than that of his fathers, Xerxes himself.